We are going to continue this morning our overview of the Bible as we have this year been journeying through God's Word. Hopefully at this point in time, if you are a member here, you have, even if you're a little bit behind on your daily Bible reading, you've read through the story of David up through his death in 2 Kings chapter 2. And again, I've had to break this section up a little bit more than I originally intended to because there's so much information. And quite frankly, the way that it's written in the text is not very chronological. And so it's been a little bit of a challenge trying to figure out the exact chronology. And again, I'm not going to bore you with how I've arrived at the chronology that I have. If you want to go through that discussion at some other time, I'd be more than happy to share with you how I arrived at the dates that I have. I'm just going to present them to you as those are the dates that we're working with and try to see how the narrative fits together today, particularly as we look at the reign of David, who is probably one of my favorite Old Testament characters. And we are just going to be skimming the surface as we go through this. But as we've done through every lesson in this series, we'll begin with the 3,000-foot overview. Again, we're covering the period of the United Kingdom, which is about 120 years worth of biblical history. But again, in our lesson today, we're only going to be focusing on the 40 years of King David's reign. And so just real quick, by way of review, some of the stuff we talked about last time with Saul's reign. His reign began with some promise, but it ended in a very inglorious manner. Him falling on his own sword, committing suicide in the end of the battle with the Philistines. And part of that was because the Spirit of the Lord had departed from Saul, because Saul had demonstrated throughout the course of his reign a pattern of relying upon himself rather than relying upon God, rather than turning to God. And therefore, giving little or no attention to God's ways throughout the course of his reign. And we also noted that in Saul's story, we have the beginning of David's story. His being born and his being anointed by Samuel as a teenager, and then his rise and fall within the ranks of Saul's army and within the family of Saul, the first monarch of Israel. Spending the last several years of Saul's reign, not as a beloved son-in-law, but as a hunted fugitive by the jealous king. And so that brings us now to the overview of David's reign. And we can sum it up by saying that upon the death of Saul, there was a time of unrest in the nation of Israel. In fact, there's a time of civil war. And David's going to spend the initial years of his reign trying to reunite the nation of Israel. And once his kingdom is consolidated, he's then going to face threats from outside enemies. And David is going to spend much of his reign engaged in warfare. And that will ultimately result in the greatest expansion of the kingdom of Israel throughout its history. But we're also going to see that David, unlike his predecessor, gave attention to the religious aspects of the nation's relationship with God. There's going to be a refocus on worship of God. There's going to be a renewed interest in the Ark of the Covenant. There's even going to be plans to build a temple, a permanent dwelling place for God in Jerusalem. And although David is not going to be allowed to build that temple himself because he is a man of much bloodshed and warfare, God is going to make a promise to him that he'll have a son who will come and build that temple. And David will spend his latter years making preparations for his son to be able to complete that monumental task. But there's also another aspect of the promise that God makes to David on that occasion, and that is reaching far beyond his son Solomon, that he would put a descendant of David's on his throne who would build an everlasting temple and reign forever. And that's the thread that we've been following throughout the course of the narrative of the Bible here, the following the line of the seed, the promise that was given even back when God was punishing Adam and Eve, that there would be enmity between the seed of woman and the seed of the serpent, and that one day he would crush the serpent on the head while the serpent bruised him on the heel. And that's speaking of Jesus Christ. And so with the establishment of the Davidic dynasty and God's promise regarding this son of David that would come and sit on the throne of David forever, reigning over God's people, we see the ultimate fulfillment of that in Christ nearly 1,000 years after the events that we're going to talk about in our study today. And so let's then dig a little bit deeper into this section. As we've pointed out in the past, this period that we're looking at, the United Kingdom, can be broken up into three stages, but all of which are 40 years apiece. Saul reigns for 40 years, David reigns for 40 years, and Solomon will then reign for 40 years. And so just again, by way of review, let's look at the reign of Saul, 1050 to 1010 BC, as it pertains to the details of David's life. David was born in the 10th year of Solomon's reign, 1040 BC. He was anointed by Samuel sometime around 1025 when he's a teenager. It's going to be a couple years after that, 1023 to 1020, that he faces the giant Goliath and begins his rise in the family and in the ranks of Israel's army. And it's going to be in his last days when Saul is fighting against the Philistines and ultimately dies in 1010 BC. That last year and 4 months leading up to that, David will have been residing in the Philistine city of Ziklag as kind of a vassal, a mercenary for the Philistines. And that's where we are going to pick up then with the reign of David. And so again, I'm going to put some of the key dates and times on the timeline here, and then we'll go back and fill in some of the more details. But David reigned for 40 years, from 1010 to 970 BC. And that year can be split up into two sections. The first 7.5 years, he reigned from the city of Hebron, and the last 33 years, after conquering the city of Jebus, renamed Jerusalem, he moves the capital to Jerusalem and reigns over the nation of Israel for 33 years. Throughout David's reign, there were actually two civil wars, one at the very outset of his reign, being led by his opponent, a son of Saul, Ishbosheth, taking the northern part of the kingdom away from him, David reigning just over Judah and Simeon from Hebron for about 2 years. And then again, towards the end of his reign, one of David's own sons is going to rise up in a revolt and try to take the kingdom away from David. And that's going to result in a rather contracted civil war, but a civil war nonetheless, in which David is ultimately victorious over his rebellious son. There is a roughly 20-year period towards the beginning of David's reign in which David will engage in 5 major military campaigns. First against the Philistines, then the Moabites, then the Ammonites, and then the Arameans, the king of Zobah, and then finally Edom in the south. And so David's reign was very much characterized by warfare. It's during this time of warfare that David, I believe, has these plans to build the temple for God. But God says, no, you're not going to be the one, rather your son. And he gives the promise to David. And it would have been a few years after this that his son, that son of promise, or at least the initial fulfillment of that, Solomon, his son, was born. Now, all of the dates with a C next to them are uncertain. That's my best guess on when those things happen based on the clues that are given to us in the text. So let's go back through then some of this and fill in some of the blanks, and I'll try to flesh out the story of David for you this morning, and then at the end we'll see if we can't learn a lesson from the example of this great monarch of the nation of Israel. Going back to the beginning, it would have been 3 days after David has secured Ziklag from the hands of the Amalekites, that he learns of the death of Saul and his good friend Jonathan, who died in the battle with the Philistines. And David is going to mourn the death of his friend, and at the same time, the people in Judah, who he has been favorable towards, are going to ask him to be their king. I've got up here on the map, we shared this map in a previous study. This was the allotted land that was allotted to the 12 tribes in the days of Joshua. But as we pointed out back when we were looking at the conquest, the reality is that even by the end of Joshua's life, Israel had only come to actually possess a small fragment of that land, not all of its entirety. And so that persisted on into the reign of Saul, who did expand and consolidate things a little bit. But now at the end of Saul's reign, we're going to see a fracture, a division. because in 2 Samuel chapter 1 and 2, David is made king over the southern tribes of Judah and Simeon, and he's going to reign at Hebron, whereas Ishbosheth, the fourth eldest son of Saul, is taken by Abner, the commander of Saul's army, to Mahanaim on the other side of the Jordan River and made king over the northern 10 tribes of Israel. David will go from Ziklag over to Hebron, and he'll reign over Judah. There we could look at this map as a representation of this division that occurred at this time in the nation's history. It would have also been at this same time that we're introduced to another character, Mephibosheth, who at the time of Saul's death was only 5 years old. And that was Saul's grandson through Jonathan. And he'll become important later on in our discussion because of the promises that David and Jonathan made to each other while they were still alive. But what's interesting about Mephibosheth is that when news came to Gibeah that Saul and Jonathan and his other brothers had died in battle, they are in a panic. And everybody is ready to get out of there and flee. And in the process, Mephibosheth's nurse, who is carrying him, falls, drops him somehow, and he is injured and lamed in both of his legs. And so he is a cripple from the age of 5 onwards in his life. This civil war that ensued between the house of Saul and the house of David occurred or lasted for roughly 2 whole years. The first 2 years of David's reign in Hebron. Now, at this time, the Philistines were probably happy to see this infighting within the nation of Israel. After all, if the nation of Israel is divided and fighting with each other, they're easier to control. It's easier for us to take advantage of the situation in the land. In fact, there's a real sense in which the king of Philistia probably looked at David at this point in time as though he was nothing more than a vassal king for himself. Remember, David had been a servant of the king of the Philistines, Achish, while he was a fugitive running from Saul. And so now he's just taken part of Saul's kingdom away from him. And I'm sure that Achish thinks, this is good for me, because now I'm actually in possession of part of the land of Israel. And so, for the first couple years, while Israel in the north and Judah in the south, David and Saul are fighting with each other, they're left relatively alone by those around them. They're not really hampered with. They're left to fight their own skirmishes and their own battles. But after 2 years, Abner, the commander of Saul's army, now the commander of Ishbosheth's army, gets a little bit peeved with Ishbosheth and says, you know what, I'm going to go over to David. And he defects. Unfortunately, Joab, the commander of David's army, doesn't like Abner, and he kills him. When that happens, now the household of Saul, Ishbosheth, is thrown into a panic again, and many of the people start to defect to David down in Hebron. And two brothers, actually go and assassinate Ishbosheth. And they come to David bringing Ishbosheth's head, maybe in a basket, I don't know. They bring it to him and say, hey, we took care of your enemy, David, reward us. And David says, okay, you're dead. Because David did not look too kindly on people who would seek to strike one of those who were of the household of Saul. Remember, David had great respect for Saul in his lifetime because he was the Lord's anointed. Even though Saul hunted him, even though Saul persecuted him, David would not raise his hand against them. And so, the kingdom then at this point, 2 years after the beginning of David's reign, the whole kingdom turns over to David. And he reigns over all of Israel for another 5 years from Hebron. And there in Hebron, he will have 6 sons by 6 different wives. Amnon, Chileab, Absalom, Adonijah, Shephathiah, and Ithream. And it's not going to be until about halfway through his 7th year that David is going to conquer the city of Jebus, renaming it Jerusalem, and move his capital there. But while we're thinking about some of the military-esque exploits of David, let me just talk about those. I don't know exactly chronologically where all of these fit in, other than to say it's within the first 20, 23 years of David's reign. But you can see by the map that David did indeed expand the borders of what became Israel proper. The first campaign he fought against was against the Philistines, and this probably happened right after David consolidated all Israel under his authority and monarchy while he's still ruling from Hebron. Because now Philistia sees David is a threat to us. He's clearly not trying to be our vassal. He's trying to set up his own kingdom, and he's in competition with us. And so there are two very early decisive victories that David wins over the Philistines in the Valley of Rephaim. And then later, David would capture Gath, which would be the mother city of the Philistines, their capital, preventing Philistia from exerting any real military power in Israel. He's not going to totally conquer the Philistines, but the Philistines are, from this point forward, going to become a weaker force and recognize the authority of David as king over all Israel. Sometime after this, he will cross the Jordan and go south of the Dead Sea and conquer the nation of the Moabites. And the Moabites then will become a vassal state to the kingdom of Israel, paying tribute yearly to David. He then goes a little bit north and he'll fight against the Ammonites, taking their capital city of Rabbah and making them, actually incorporating them into the nation of Israel. They're not a vassal state. He totally conquers them and he becomes their king. He rules over them with his own government. He'll then go towards the north because the Arameans were actually helping the people of Ammon in that battle. And when they realized they were defeated, they fled. But David gives chase to them. He conquers the Arameans in the north, taking much possession of much of their land and turning them into a vassal state as well. And what's interesting, it's not on this map, you'll see it here in a little bit, but north of the Arameans was the land of Hamath, which stretched from Aram's northern borders all the way to the river Euphrates. Now, he then went south into Edom. And I would suggest to you it's probably because he was occupied in the north. The Edomites thought, here's our opportunity to attack David from the backside, essentially. And David says, nope. And he comes down and he wipes out the Edomites as well, making them into a vassal state. And at the end of these campaigns, Israel reaches its zenith, because in addition to conquering all of these neighboring states, he had also made treaties with Hiram, the king of Tyre, and the Phoenicians, and a marriage alliance with the king of Geshur. And so all of this land around him is either his ally, recognizing his authority in Philistia, or has become essentially incorporated into his kingdom. And so if we zoom out on the map just a little bit, you can see the expanse of King David's rule. And the reason why I bring this all up is because it follows this thread through Scripture of God's promises. Early on, God made a promise to Abraham in Genesis chapter 15 and verse 18. And he said to Abraham, when he's standing in the land of promise, he says, to your descendants, I have given this land. From the river of Egypt, which would have been the brook of Egypt down here on the southern border of Judah, all the way to the great river, the river Euphrates, which would have been the northern border of Hamath. And so we see God keeping his promise here to Abraham through his descendant David and the military expansions that he's made during his reign. Now, during this same time period, there are some other events that we read about in our readings that occurred during this time. And these are far from being in chronological order as you read through the text. Let me just point out some of them to you and tell you roughly where I believe they fit in. In 2 Samuel chapter 21, we have the story of 3 years of drought. And David inquires of the Lord, why are we having this drought? It was obviously from a supernatural cause. And God tells David it's because Saul, your predecessor, had attacked the Gibeonites and tried to annihilate them. Now, if you remember back from the story of Joshua and the conquest of the land, Joshua had made an ill-advised covenant with the Gibeonites and agreed to protect them, even though they lived within the land of people they were supposed to destroy. Now, I don't know if Saul was maybe thinking, I'm going to right a wrong that my predecessor Joshua made, and so that was his motivation in trying to wipe out the Gibeonites. But at any rate, God was not happy with him. And I would suggest to you this, that illustrates the point that when we make promises, even make promises that aren't the best for us, God takes our promises seriously. And he expects us to be a people of our word, even if sometimes that's to our own harm. And I would suggest to you that that event occurred probably in the early days of David's reign, maybe after his war with the Philistines, maybe while he was still in Hebron, maybe just shortly after he took Jerusalem and became made Jerusalem his capital city. And of course, that is told to us in 2 Samuel chapter 5. He has the excursion against Jerusalem. We know that had to have been in his seventh year of reign, because he's only in Hebron 7.5 years, and then he moves to the capital and is there for the last 33 years of his reign. It's going to be there in Jerusalem that he will build a house for himself. And, you know, sometimes we think about these construction projects and we think in our own time frame, like, how long did it take to build your house when it was built? Probably less than a year. In the way we frame up houses and build them today, maybe if you did it yourself, it took you a little bit longer than that. I don't know. Solomon will build a house for himself when he becomes king. And the text tells us that it took 13 years for Solomon to build his house. It'll take 7 years for Solomon to build the temple. And so I just want you to understand that the scale of these projects, it wasn't like throwing up a timber frame house, okay, that happened in a short period of time. David was in Jerusalem, that was his capital, for many years by the time his house is completed. And that's important because we're going to see that when David does ultimately have plans to move the ark to Jerusalem and to build the temple in Jerusalem, his house is already built and he's living in his house. Sometimes we read through the text and we think, oh, he captured Jerusalem and the next day he moved the ark there. That's not how it happened. It's probably years in between those events. There in Jerusalem, though, David is going to marry more wives. He's going to take more concubines. And over the rest of his life, anyway, the next 33 years, he's going to father 11 additional sons and many daughters. It'll also be in Jerusalem that David, in 2 Samuel chapter 11 and 12, commits his great sin with Bathsheba. She's a married woman, married to Uriah. Uriah, by the way, is one of David's mighty men, one of his valiant warriors who's been with him from the time that he was a fugitive under Saul. He's his pal, his buddy. And David takes his wife, sleeps with her. She becomes pregnant. David tries to cover up his sin by having Uriah come back and sleep with his wife. Uriah is too faithful to David and won't do it. And so David orchestrates the murder of Uriah. In the war against the Ammonites, while the city of Rabbah, the capital of Ammon, is under siege by his commander Joab. And so we know that this event took place during that military campaign while David is fighting against the Ammonites. Of course, David thought he hid his sin. He took Bathsheba, the widow of Uriah, as his wife. She has the child, and David thinks all is well, but the Lord did not look favorably upon him. He sends Nathan to confront him. He tells him the story about the rich man and the poor man and the ewe little sheep. David is irate, and Nathan says to him the famous lines, "You are the man." David confesses his sin, God forgives him his sin, and yet there is still the punishment that the child will die. So even though we read about that story in the span of just, you know, two chapters, we're talking about a year's worth of time being occupied there, because not only has Bathsheba become pregnant, she brings the child to term, has the child, and the infant child then dies after David confesses his sin. Towards the end of this time period, there are four major events that take place. One is the census and the plague. That's recorded for us in 2 Samuel chapter 24. And even though I understand that that comes at the very end of David's story in Samuel, that's not something that happened at the end of his life. It probably happened towards the tail end of all of his military campaigns. And David is thinking, man, I've amassed a great land for myself. I've got a lot of people I'm ruling over. I want to know just how well I'm doing. Of course, that was a census that was not authorized by God. And so God sends a plague to punish David's hubris and pride. And it's there at the threshing floor of Araunah the Jebusite, just on Mount Moriah, outside at that time the city of Jerusalem, that David comes into contact with the angel of death who's coming through and bringing this plague, and he offers up the sacrifice to God, buying the ox and the threshing sledge and all that from Araunah, and offering the oxen there as a burnt offering to the Lord. What's interesting to me, you read that account in 1 Chronicles, and it's at that point that David says, here is the place where I've seen God. This is where his temple will be. And so that tells me that somewhere right around that time was when David had moved the ark into Jerusalem. You remember it had the ill-fated attempt at first. They tried to move it on the cart, and Uzzah reached out to steady the ark as it was about to be overturned, and God struck him dead right then because they weren't moving the Ark of the Covenant the way that God had commanded. And so it sets for 3 months, and 3 months later, David comes back with the Levites, and they carry the ark the proper way and put it into a tent in the city of Jerusalem. And it's probably very shortly after this, David is sitting in his nice, comfortable house, and he's thinking, I'm sitting in this great palace, and God's ark is sitting out in a tent. That doesn't seem right to me. I'm going to build him a greater house for him than what I had for myself. And initially, Nathan says, go for it. But then God comes and says, no, tell David he's not going to be the one to build the temple for me, because he's a man of bloodshed. But I will create a house for David and establish his house. And I'll give him a son who will build this temple and will reign on David's throne forever. And again, as we pointed out, that was something that was ultimately fulfilled in Jesus Christ, but it had an immediate application in the son Solomon, who was then born to David sometime right after this. And again, I point this out because if you went through the readings, you read in 2 Samuel chapter 11 through 12, David's sin with Bathsheba, the murder of Uriah, the confrontation with Nathan, the death of the child, and then, boom, immediately the birth of Solomon. And then you read about the end of the war with Ammon. And I would suggest to you that even though we read about Solomon's birth there in 2 Samuel chapter 12, that's probably chronologically not where it actually fits in to the narrative. It's probably some years later, as Solomon will still be a very young man when he ascends to the throne of David. Now, David's last years, from 986 on, are characterized by internal conflict within his family. We have, in 986, Amnon, David's eldest son, becoming infatuated with his half-sister Tamar. So much so that he gets her to himself, and he ends up raping the poor girl, and then sending her away because it says the hate with which he hated her was greater than the love with which he loved her. Well, Tamar's brother, Absalom, did not look too kindly upon that. But he was a patient man. He bided his time, and 2 years later, he invited his brother, his half-brother Amnon, to the sheep shearing. And there he orchestrated the murder of Amnon. Now, obviously, David, their father, was not too happy about this. And so Absalom fled to his grandfather's kingdom, Geshur, which was just north of the Sea of Galilee. And there he hides out for 3 years before finally Joab is able to get David to recall Absalom to him in Jerusalem. And Absalom will come back to Jerusalem and sit in Jerusalem for 2 full years before David finally allows him to come into his presence. That David and Absalom have a strained relationship, I think, is an understatement. And from this point forward, 979, Absalom will spend the next 4 years plotting his revolt. And at the end of 4 years, after currying the favor of many of the people of the nation of Israel, he has himself declared king in place of his father. And this causes David to have to flee Jerusalem, and he goes to none other place than Mahanaim, where Ishbosheth had fled all those years before, and hides there. Absalom will go into Jerusalem and take possession of the city, defiling David's concubines that he had left behind to take care of his house. And thankful to the good or bad advice, however you want to look at it, of one of David's faithful servants, Absalom delays chasing his father to attack him. Gives David and his men time to regroup. And when the battle ensues on the other side of the Jordan, in the forest of Ephraim, Absalom, who had those beautiful, long, glowing locks of hair, got his hair stuck in the branches of a tree as he's riding on his mule. And there he hung, stuck, until Joab came and puts three spears through his heart. And then has his men strike him down. I'll just say this, Absalom was a tough dude. Three spears through your heart, and you're still kicking. You got to have some other guys come and finish the job. Now, David is distraught over this because he didn't really want his son to die. He probably wanted to reconcile with him, but it wasn't to be. So David then returns to Jerusalem, where he is reestablished as the king over the nation of Israel. Now, in the midst of that, a fellow by the name of Sheba thought, here's my opportunity to take advantage of the situation. And he tries to lead a revolt and ends up running and hiding in a city called Abel, and quite literally loses his head as a result of his insurrection. The last 5 years or so of David's reign, he spends making preparations for the temple, gathering materials, making plans, ordering the Levitical priests and how they will perform the duties in the temple and the song worship and the instruments and all of that kind of stuff, trying to make it ready for his son Solomon, who was still young at this time. Unfortunately, David's fourth eldest son, who is probably now the eldest because Amnon's dead, Chileab is probably dead, and Absalom is dead, Adonijah says, well, I'm the next eldest, I should be king. And he tries to have himself declared king. But David, at the urging of Nathan and Bathsheba, based on a prior promise, not just that God had made about Solomon, but that David apparently had made to Bathsheba that her son, Solomon, would sit on the throne after him, David publicly declares Solomon as his successor. And there is a peaceful transfer of power. And some of the last things we read about David are the charge that he gives to his son Solomon. Solomon, I've made all this preparation for this great work to build the temple for God. Follow through on it. Be a man. And make sure that you follow God. Keep his commandments. Follow his precepts. Do what he says so that it may be well with you and your kingdom will last. And then finally, David dies at the age of 70 and is buried there. And Solomon begins his reign. Now, in our next lesson, we're going to look at Solomon and see how he fared during his reign. And though he will begin well, he will later on in his life falter in many ways. And we're going to see how the groundwork ultimately is laid for the development of the divided kingdom under his son, Rehoboam. And that'll be in June's readings. But let me just pause here and make this application, a lesson that we can learn from David. And it's really something that I see in contrast to the guy who came before him and the guy who's going to come after him. Saul started out well, seeking God. He had the Spirit of God on him, but he consistently put confidence in himself instead of turning to God. He was overcome by fear, as we talked about last time. And he let that fear draw him further and further away from God. And so as an old man, he's seeking spirit mediums to find out what he's supposed to do rather than getting information from God. Now Solomon, David's successor, is going to start out well as a young man. He's going to receive all the wisdom and riches and knowledge and possessions and all that kind of stuff from God. He's going to accomplish a lot of great things, but later in his life he's going to marry many foreign women. And their devotion to their gods is going to draw away Solomon's heart in his later years from God. So in contrast to those two guys, Saul and Solomon, what I see in David is a guy who from his beginning and to his end lots of imperfections along the way. But one thing that was consistent, he sought the Lord his God. And you know, something that I think about us sometimes is we sometimes have this attitude of, well, I've been serving God faithfully all my life or all these years. I've been a Christian for 20, 30, 40 years. I'm tired. I'm ready to sit back. I'm ready to let the next generation step up and take the reins and do the work. That cannot be our attitude. Not if we're going to be like our forefather David. Because even as an old man who needed a nurse to take care of him in his bed, he's still making preparations for his son to fulfill the work that needs to be done. And so, old people, I'm going to talk to you for a second and say this. I appreciate all the hard work that you've done over the years. I appreciate your faithfulness and your example and your consistency. I appreciate the fact that we would not be here today if it had not been for you old folks and the older folks before you who had shared the gospel and who had sought to establish a congregation in this town. But let me tell you this, the work is not done. The work is not over. We have more building that we need to do. And if my generation and the generation that comes after me is going to be successful, we are going to be relying upon every generation, no matter how old we get, to have the attitude that David had that said, there is more work that the Lord wants me to do, and I'm going to do it. Are you ready to do the work of the Lord? If you are, let's stand and sing.